Command. Military command has been reconstructed and revolutionized since the Second World War by nuclear warfare, small-scale guerrilla land operations, and cyber interference. In this new book, Sir Lawrence Friedman takes a global perspective, investigating its practice and politics since 1945. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from the UK, author of Command, Sir Lawrence Friedman. Good morning to you, Sir Lawrence.
Good morning. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you with us. Is it fair to assume that the nature of structure and command then in the military has changed in a way that was revolutionary, that hadn't been changed for centuries after the Second World War?
I wouldn't put it that far. I think there's a lot of continuities in command. The militaries depend on discipline. They have hierarchies that send down orders. If they're not followed, there's trouble. There's issues, always issues of insubordination. How much initiative do you give to lower ranks and so on? So there's a lot of continuity in command. But I think there are certain things, as you mentioned before, like particularly nuclear war, the counterinsurgency, the fact that so many contemporary wars are in areas that used to be colonized by the great European powers. All of these, it's the changing nature of warfare, I think, that is as important as the changing nature of command itself. And that has created a quite different political context.
Could you argue that perhaps it's, whereas during, say, the 18th, 19th, 20th, well, early 20th century, this was part, you know, wars, battles were sort of fought along certain structural lines. So they would be fought between professional armies, mainly. They were relatively small-scale events, even something like a Waterloo. And they didn't have much of an impact on, for example, a civilian population yet. Second World War, 1945, and from onwards you get the concept of total war, which involves large-scale operations, huge amounts of ground being covered because of aerial warfare, and obviously civilian populations are this is the targeting of towns and cities.
Yeah, I think all that's fair. I think the sort of ideal type warfare that you see influencing a lot of 19th century military thinking is essentially a set piece battle that takes place over a day. And at the end of it, you look at who's had the most casualties, who's taken the prisoners, who owns the battlefield, and you decide who's won, and the politics is sorted out from then on. It was always the case that civilians got hurt, and it was always the case that you could have guerrilla warfare. The term comes, in fact, from the Napoleonic Wars. But that was the sort of the ideal type. And you still see in the West in particular a desire to get back to that ideal type. Yet increasingly, the interaction between the military operations and civil society has become intense. And basically, if you depend on your factories for war production, on your civilian areas to provide the recruits for the soldiers and so on, then you soon have a case for attacking them as much as just attacking the frontline troops. So the move to total war was very strong throughout the 20th century. It reached a culminating point with nuclear weapons because, in a sense, that was a logical place where you couldn't go any further. It had just stopped. If you fought wars to the end with nuclear weapons, there wouldn't be much left to consider as part of your victory.
And that presumably has changed strategic thinking, or at least did during, say, you know, the height of the Cold War. So Cold War. So from 1940, 1948, 1949 through to, shall we say, 82 to 85, that, you know, those are the constructs that you had on a military chain of command, because you had that, all, you know, the mutually assured destruction button hanging over you.
Yeah, I think from the Korean War onwards, it's influenced certainly political thinking and military thinking. You can see its influence at the moment as well. We don't want a major war between nuclear powers, and therefore, though in other circumstances we might have seen Western countries more actively engaged in the war over Ukraine, they're holding back for that reason. So nuclear weapons have limited the ways that wars have gone on, and raise this question with every conflict that's taken place involving the United States, the Soviet Union, then Russia, now China, as to whether or not you escalate. how you control the process by which a war might just get out of hand and you no longer control what's happening.
But then again, you look at the situations that could have gone nuclear. I mean, there was an argument that, you know, some people were saying Truman should have gone nuclear in Korea in the 50s. We had the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, which was very, very close indeed. And then there, you know, there were reports that Nixon was looking at using the possibility of nuclear weapons in Vietnam. So is there some sort of, should we say, a moral argument, or it was just deemed too horrendous to contemplate in what was Cuban Missile Crisis, notwithstanding what were, if you like, kind of proxy wars, as the modern parlance would say?
I think if you go back to Truman, I think there's been a combination of factors. Certainly, there's been a moral argument. If you look back at Truman's decision-making, one of the factors that influenced him was the argument that it would be seen in Asia as if the United States was prepared to bomb Asians, but no, irradiate Asians, but nobody else. This is the moral argument that these are horrific weapons. Secondly, there's a practical argument also, if you look at Truman's decision, how actually would you use these weapons effectively, especially when your troops and the enemy troops were quite close together and working in proximity? What difference would it actually make? And also, at the start of the Korean War, there just weren't very many weapons around. That's obviously not the issue now. So I think there's been this combination of practicality. What I think governments have sometimes done, and Nixon certainly thought in these terms, was let it be known that they might, it might have a coercive effect just by showing that you're the sort of character who might indeed take this tremendous catastrophic step.
What effect did the Cuban Missile Crisis have on realpolitik, stroke geopolitik, stroke trains of command? Because, you know, it was, as people look back at the 60s in that sort of rose-tinted binoculars type of style, not realizing it wasn't all flower power, peace of love, and everybody driving minis around the place, you know. And this was, you know, there were Russians, you know, the Russian ships were sailing towards Cuba. You know, people talk about going out to look perhaps for the mushroom clouds in the States. So, you know, how big an impact did that have on the strategic thinking and command from that early stage? And the hangover sort of continued through the 60s and 70s.
Yes, I in fact can remember it. The Cuban, which I go into in some detail in the book, is interesting because it's a very good example of Kennedy, and for that matter Khrushchev, both being anxious that this didn't turn into a nuclear war, both being prepared to make compromises to make sure that didn't happen, but having their own difficulties with their chain of command. In some ways, the Russian difficulties were more severe because they'd sent submarines off to the Caribbean carrying nuclear torpedoes. And actually, in the end, there was a degree of discretion about whether these torpedoes were used or not. And there's one moment when, and historians can disagree about how serious this was, but certainly when there was a possibility that one of these submarines might have used a torpedo against American ships that were tailing it. So, and at the same time, the Kennedy administration had big arguments with the chiefs of staff, who felt that he was being too weak, that here was an opportunity to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba, and it wasn't being taken. One of the conclusions Kennedy came to remarked at the end of the crisis that he would tell his successors not to take too much notice of military opinions, because they were immature. So I think that it revealed important tensions between the military and the politicians, which are not unusual in war and have been present in war since. But it was a scary time. And found, you know, one of the beneficial effects of the Cuban Missile Crisis, by getting so close to the brink, is that Kennedy in particular began an initiative to ease relations with the Soviet Union. This is when you got the hotline implemented, so you could always communicate with your opposite number in a crisis.
Vietnam's always been an interesting one, or Indochina, as the French called it before they lost it, in spectacular fashion. And Vietnam's an interesting for several reasons. One is it's two different styles of warfare. In terms of you have the Viet Cong and Ho Chi Minh with a fast and mobile guerrilla force. Okay, you have the NVA army, but they were essentially a hit and run operation. And you have the Americans with overwhelming firepower, technology, and equipment, yet unable, because they are playing a war game which is solely based on a number of casualties. So they try and reduce war to a formula. And famously, in order to save the village, we had to destroy it, which is one of the quotes of the Vietnam War. And being unable to make a lasting victory on Vietnam. And then B, we have the influence of media in war. And that, because you have the reports being, Walter Cronkite and reports being beamed into American, American living rooms in a way it hadn't been possible. And the amount of free access that the American military gave to journalists and cameramen, for better or worse.
Yeah, I think the best example of this is the Tet Offensive in early 1968, which eventually led to Lyndon Johnson deciding not to run again because the media impact of the Viet Cong appearing in Saigon and other South Vietnamese cities, when there'd been confident claims by the American military that they were getting it under control, which in some ways actually they were, was a big media shock. Actually, it was a catastrophic military defeat for the Viet Cong, from which they never really recovered. And there was far less guerrilla warfare in Vietnam after the Tet Offensive. But politically, it had done its damage. And that influenced North Vietnamese thinking, so that in 1972, which is the episode covered in my book, they launched a pretty conventional war, because they couldn't do it by guerrilla means anymore, with the 1972 election in mind, hoping to have the same effect. But Nixon was a much more ruthless figure at this point. And also, the North Vietnamese weren't as good at conventional war then as they had been at guerrilla warfare. So, as you say, if you go right back to the episode I also cover in the 1950s, the early 1950s, 1954, with Dien Bien Phu, that again, the Vietnamese were fighting in a pretty conventional way with artillery barrages again, as well against a Chinese garrison. It was only the bit in the middle that they largely relied on guerrilla warfare. The idea was always with guerrilla warfare that as you succeeded, you would form a conventional force that would then be able to take on the enemy in its own terms. And eventually, of course, in 75, with the Americans gone, the North Vietnamese were able to do that.
Mm-hmm. You also have a particular interest and speciality in the Falklands War, the Falklands Campaign. And people have argued, and it's for 40 years ago now, people have argued that, that was a case where media access absolutely wasn't allowed, because it was back to old style. But B, some people are saying it was almost a throwback. It was a last, if you like, hurrah of empire.
Well, I mean, it was to protect a colony. Although in this case, the colony wanted to stay part of, stay connected with the UK. It's not true there wasn't any media access. A lot of journalists went along with the task force and reported back. But unlike now, it could take days before TV images could get back. It was a radio war, and it was there was quite strict censorship going on, because it was also a very tight campaign. It was seen at the time as a throwback, because it wasn't guerrilla warfare. It was wasn't even a lot of air. There was air power, wasn't a lot of that. It was infantry and a hard slog, rather than a naval warfare, which we haven't actually seen as much maritime encounters Largely think of modern wars as being fought on land, but here was one where some of the most important episodes were at sea. So it did feel at the time quite different from what we'd been used to, although we've had more aspects like that since.
And here we are talking about access and media and how it shapes opinion. We're now engaged in a conflict in Ukraine where Twitter, social media are beaming back images every day. And, you know, we still see superpowers, how you want to call it, engaged in wars. And some would say, oh, this is a proxy war between Ukraine and the former Soviet Union. How has that shaped command, or is that particular command a case in point?
I think Ukraine is a fascinating example of command at all sorts of different levels. So the most important level is obviously the decision to go to war in the first place. The commander in Putin's Russia is commander in chief on these things, and it just seems to me to show the dangers of somebody who's isolated and autocratic and limited accountability, taking a decision that has quite catastrophic consequences, not only for Ukraine, but for Russia as well, over the long term. So there's command at that level. There's command at a level that is important in terms of how hierarchical your command structures are. Almost by necessity, the Ukrainians had to be very flexible, had to give a lot of discretion to those at the front lines to take their own initiatives. Russian military don't seem so good at that. If they're told to attack, they'll keep on attacking the same target, even if they keep on getting rebuffed. And then there's all these new elements of the information war that come about because of social medias. I've followed wars for a long time. It's quite extraordinary just how much detail you get. You have to be careful because that's selective. Mm. You're not seeing everything. I've seen some of the stuff that you really wouldn't want to be out too far on social media. It's pretty horrific stuff. There's an effort going on to shape the way that we think about it. And that relates to sort of another level which this war is being conducted, which is in Western capitals, not to fight themselves, but the degree of support they give to Ukraine and the economic pressure we are being put under by Russia using gas supplies, and equally the economic pressure we're putting them under with sanctions. At all these different levels, you can see decision making, which is what command in the end is about, being in quite new and quite complex, because all these factors interact with each other. The way the war's going at the moment is very much influenced by the fact that Western countries have supplied modern weapons in significant numbers to the Ukrainians, without which they wouldn't be able to fight in the way they're fighting at all.
What do you hope that people will learn and take from your book, Command?
Well, I think the first thing to take is that there's no clear separation between civilians setting objectives and the military professionally then implementing them. The military need to think about the political context in which they're operating, and the civilians need to understand what they're asking the military to do. Secondly, I think this point that I would make about Putin, it's remarkable. It really struck me as I was writing it how often autocrats make truly terrible decisions on war. It doesn't stop Western democracies, before anybody points out Iraq and Afghanistan, making pretty poor decisions. But we have an adaptability that they often lack. And I think there is an important difference between the two, where they make decisions are made. And I think the third area is this question of how command systems generally cope with a much more flexible and complex situation in which you have to worry about information operations and cyber attacks and economic dimensions and all these other things as well.
The book is called Command. It's by Sir Lawrence Freedman, who we've been speaking to today. Sir Lawrence, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.